Ms. Skelton, we'll be glad to hear from you, ma'am.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Megan Skelton, arguing this morning on behalf of Marcus Hill, the appellant. After Officer Conaway aimed his gun and shot at Marcus Hill without probable cause or reasonable suspicion, the police searched his car pursuant to a warrant that was invalid on its face and was the fruit of other Fourth Amendment violations. I'd like to start with expanding on our argument that the warrant was invalid on its face. Then I'd like to move on to the other Fourth Amendment violations and the Alford plea issue. First, the warrant says four different, the application says twice and the warrant itself says twice that the police asked for permission to search for fruits of the evidence of murder, and the magistrate authorized the police to search for evidence of murder. The affidavit, which is the thing that is supposed to provide the probable cause for the warrant, has no mention of a dead body, no murder. The government agrees no murder happened. The application, the warrant, and the affidavit are ships passing in the night. There's absolutely no relationship between what the warrant authorizes and what the affidavit establishes probable cause for.
Well, the warrant has to qualify in two ways, where to search and what to search for. Didn't the warrant do that?
No, Your Honor, it did not. It did identify where to search. It identified the car, but it did not properly identify what to search for because it told the police that they were authorized to search for fruits of the evidence of murder. This is an almost identical situation.
Wouldn't a gun be the fruits of the evidence had there been a murder?
If there had been a murder, perhaps, but we know that there was not. This case is almost identical to this court's decision in Doyle last spring and to the Third Circuit's decision in Virgin Islands versus John, where an affidavit suggests that one offense occurred, but the warrant provides authorization to search for fruits of a different crime. Both of those cases stand together to say that the warrant is not supported by probable cause. It is as if it was a warrantless search.
Well, Ms. Galton, the affidavit says in the fourth paragraph, the female victim witness, referring to Mr. Hill's companion, gave a statement, and from that statement, the investigators, quote, learned that moments before the shooting, the female received an assault by threat with a possible gun by Marcus Hill. Does not that statement and the affidavit as a whole provide probable cause to believe that a gun, or a possible gun, if you will, would likely be found in this vehicle, which was used in an assault on Mr. Hill's companion?
Judge Davis, if...
And if not, why not?
No.
Okay.
And there's several problems with that statement.
Okay.
A couple have to do with some of my other Fourth Amendment arguments. First, it is the fruit of the other warrantless illegal seizure.
I don't understand that at all. They learned from her, one, that she needed help, according to that mysterious note.
Right.
And two, as the affiant say, they later talked to her after the shooting and learned, according to the affidavit, that he had threatened her with a gun.
That's correct. That is in the affidavit. That is insufficient.
That is insufficient for what purpose?
For providing probable cause in this warrant.
And so why?
Because the warrant authorizes the police to search for murder, evidence
of
murder.
Well, see, I understand your point about the murder. But just looking, as Judge Kaiser suggested in his question, just looking at the affidavit and asking, is there probable cause, and more importantly, perhaps, is there a substantial basis for the state judge to have found probable cause to believe that evidence of a criminal offense, namely assault under Maryland law, would be found in this vehicle. And I'm having a hard time understanding why, with all respect to the detective, as poorly drafted as this affidavit is, in all candor, why, when you really look at it, it's there. He's saying there's a gun in this car. We believe there's a gun in this car. We believe it was used to assault this female, and we think we're going to find it if you issue this warrant for us.
Judge Davis, there's a couple problems with
okay.
the statement.
All right. None of that, to go back to your earlier point, none of that is the fruit of anything poisonous.
Well, I disagree with
okay,
that.
Okay, what's poisoned about that part of the affidavit?
They only get to interview Miss Bennett after the illegal stop and shooting. So they only have access to her interview because of the illegal arrest.
Boy, that's a tough argument for you to make. Go ahead and make it. I don't see that at all.
Well, particularly since you didn't make it below. The whole focus of the argument below was this warrant issue.
Well, I have a couple questions that I want to answer. I want to talk about the preservation issue, Judge Diaz. And I also want to talk about how she is not an independent source, Judge Davis, but I want to quickly say that still, facially, the warrant is invalid. Briefly, the reason it is facially invalid is because you can't separate the probable cause analysis that the magistrate has to conduct from what the affidavit establishes. It is true that the affidavit could suggest one offense might have occurred. I have some problems with
that. It does more than suggest it.
That is exactly, but that's exactly what this court in Doyle said was insufficient, and what...
I don't want to put words in your mouth, but let me ask you if this isn't what you're arguing. It says that the server of the warrant can search a 2000 Buick Silver in color bearing Maryland tag, so forth and so forth. That tells us the place to be searched, right?
Absolutely.
And then to search for what? To search for weapons, ammunition, papers of any item pertaining to the crime of murder. Now, is there any evidence or any weapons or ammunition that is reasonably or probably connected to a crime of murder?
Absolutely not.
So your, if I'm understanding your argument, the search is not in a vacuum, it's as to some crime.
Exactly.
And we don't have a crime.
Exactly.
Therefore, the things to be searched for are invalid.
That's correct. That's correct.
I'm not trying to pin you down, I'm trying to understand your argument.
Well, there are like 5 or 6 Fourth Amendment violations that happened here, and that is one of them. And I wanted to take some time on that because we didn't brief it as extensively as the others. But that is exactly the issue, that you can't separate the probable cause analysis. That when an affidavit says one thing and a warrant says another, it's the warrant that needs to be supported by the probable cause in the affidavit. You can't pretend that the two are just totally independent actors. But Judge Diaz, I'd like to turn to your question about whether we can validly argue about the illegal arrest to begin with. And yes is the answer to that. We can. I am not going to lie to you. I would rather that the record in the district court was different from what it is. I think I would have much easier time coming to you, talking to you about an illegal arrest and an illegal shooting if the litigation before the district court had looked different than it did. That does not mean that the objections were insufficient. We filed 2 motions to suppress in the district court. And the motions to suppress, one explicitly said there was an illegal arrest, and one explicitly said all other warrantless searches and seizures violated the Fourth Amendment. Not to mention the fact that overall, the overarching claim in the suppression litigation was that the police obtained the firearm in violation of the Fourth Amendment. That is our overarching constitutional claim. Now, they focused on the facial validity of the warrant in the district court. My briefing starts out with the earlier Fourth Amendment violations, the ones that happened before that. That doesn't mean that we didn't argue that those were violations of the Fourth Amendment below. We are not asking you to do something that we did not ask Judge Quarles to do. We asked him to suppress the gun. We are asking you to reverse his decision to refuse to suppress the gun.
But you asked him to suppress the gun primarily on the theory of the defective warrant, not with respect to an illegal arrest or an illegal shooting. And the whole purpose of holding a trial counsel to the arguments he or she raises below is to give the district judge an opportunity in the first instance to make that call. We don't have that here.
I disagree that we don't. There are regularly objections that are made simply for preservation without further elaboration, and those objections are still preserved. Under the Yee case...
Even if there are no findings bearing on those objections?
Well, here we do...
How can the district court be faulted for not making any findings that the district court has never asked to make?
We do have a factual record regarding this. The video was presented to the district court at the time that the suppression motion was under advisement. So we do
have... How does the video help you?
The video helps us extensively, Your Honor.
How?
Because the video shows that there is about 2 seconds between when Officer Conaway is aiming his gun at Marcus Hill and when the shots are fired.
I couldn't tell from looking at the video when the shots were fired.
I have it at...
Anyway, but how does that even help you? I still don't.
That helps us because it makes it abundantly clear that this was not a Terry stop, it wasn't an illegal arrest, and we know that there was no probable cause.
But that's a legal conclusion, whether it was a Terry stop. I'm concerned about the absence of any findings.
Your Honor, findings, again, findings would help.
I appreciate your candor.
I'm not going to say that this is like the record I would, you know, dream about.
Sure.
But despite, you know, it not being the record I would dream about, it's not a nightmare record for me either. We have a motion. We asked the judge to suppress the gun. We supplied a basis for it. There's a factual record before the judge. So is it preserved beautifully? Perhaps not. Is it preserved? Yes.
So did I understand you to suggest in response to one of my earlier comments that I forget her name.
Nikia Bennett.
Miss
Bennett.
Miss Bennett is the fruit of a poison tree?
That is correct.
How on earth can that be?
Because the police only have access to her. They have her note. The note is not any fruit. No problem with the note. Any statement that she made after the shooting, they only have access to her because as a direct result of the illegal arrest.
And is that premised on an implication that he would have started the car and driven off and they never would have been able to talk to her? Is that what you're getting at?
Well, to be honest, Judge Davis, I think that there is a gulf of options between letting her drive off and shooting.
No, she wasn't driving.
No, she wasn't. No.
So there are two options facing these officers. I don't think you dispute that under the circumstances, when she slid that note across the counter, help, a police officer would have been grossly in dereliction of his or her duty not to follow her out of that 7-Eleven and investigate the circumstance.
There
right?
is no question whatsoever. That he
so they had two options. Well, they had more than two options. They could come out with their guns drawn as they did, or they could come out in a more relaxed way and approach him and or her and say, what's going on? Now, I think what they would say is what they did say. She's armed. She comes into the 7-Eleven armed. And so any reasonable person would clearly infer that the fact that she's armed isn't a source of relief for her.
Absolutely.
And so I don't understand how you can possibly argue that they would not have had an opportunity, that they did not have an opportunity to engage with her but for the shooting. They surely would have talked to her.
They didn't have, the only reason they had access to her was because they arrested Marcus Hill.
That's not true. They could have said, ma'am, just a moment, please.
But they didn't. And
well,
certainly
but the
could
point
have.
Is, they could have. And, yeah. And either way, they would have talked to her. And she would have told, why'd you give me this note? Because he's got a gun in the car. He's threatening me.
Well, if they had done that, then she might have been an independent source. But that is not what happened.
Okay. Your Honor, I understand your argument is that they didn't have probable cause to make an arrest.
Correct.
But assume for the sake of argument that they did have probable cause to make an arrest. Does the warrant become immaterial at that point in time, the search warrant?
I'm sorry, Judge Kaiser, if they did have probable cause?
Did they have a right to search the car pursuant to a legal arrest?
No, because under Gant, Mr. Hill was no longer anywhere near the car at this point. Officer Alvarez did do an initial search when he just after they shot him, but by the time they had seized the vehicle, Gant would no longer provide a warrantless search incident to arrest.
The probable cause would not carry over to the police station where they did the thorough search?
Correct. Not without a warrant. The warrant is necessary still. I see my time is up. I don't want to abandon
my... I'm going to give you a little bit more time because we had a lot of questions. And did you want to say anything else on preservation beyond what you...
I don't have anything in addition to what I've said.
Okay. Did you want to say anything else on... Or you haven't really addressed the sentencing issue.
I do want to address that. Convictions arising from Alford pleas do not qualify as Armed Career Criminal Act predicates when the modified categorical approach applies. Here, there's no question the modified categorical approach applied. Here, there's no question that it was an Alford plea. There's no question that Mr. Davis affirmatively denied doing anything wrong.
So if a person pleads guilty to an indictment charging first-degree murder that specifies the victim, the time, the manner of death, everything, Alford plea to first-degree murder, your argument is that that wouldn't count as an armed career criminal qualified?
That is not my argument. And the
okay,
reason.
So what is the distinction?
The distinction is whether the modified categorical approach applies.
Well, don't you look at the charging document under the modified categorical approach?
If it's not an Alford plea, you can. When there...
Wait, your argument is that, I'm sorry, I didn't understand that.
Okay.
Under the modified categorical approach, you look at the charging document.
That, yes.
Is it your argument that you can't look at the charging document?
I think I misspoke
okay,
a moment ago.
Okay.
I'm not sure if I, what I mean to say is generally, under the modified categorical approach, a charging document is certainly a Shepherd-approved document.
Right.
What needs to happen with the modified categorical approach is we need to figure out some additional fact, something else other than the bare statutory elements.
No, but lots of indictments give you everything you need. In my hypothetical, a first-degree murder charge in most states are going to give you everything you need.
That's correct. And that's a categorical crime of violence. So there you don't actually need the facts there. You would need the additional facts in a situation like this where possession with intent to distribute, the bare statutory offense. There's no question that that is an ambiguous charge. The statute itself does not establish that there was an Armed Career Criminal Act predicate.
What about the fact that really, with respect to the serious drug offense component of this ACCA enhancement, what we're looking at is not necessarily the predicate acts, but the sentence that's to be imposed. Because as I read the statute, it's a serious drug offense if a sentence of 10 or more years is imposed for the offense. Even under Alford, there's got to be some correlation between the minimum conduct and the sentence. So even taking your argument as true, the fact of the matter is that your client was sentenced for a Schedule II controlled substance. Maybe he didn't admit to it being cocaine, but at a minimum, the fact is that he was in fact punished for a Schedule II controlled substance. And isn't that enough to get us to where we need to be in this case?
It is not, and there's a couple reasons why, Judge Diaz. First, whether there was an illegal sentence in the Maryland court, and that may well be, without without proper admissions, it's possible that that was an illegal sentence. That might be an issue for quorum nobis under Maryland law. That's not something that we can challenge.
Well, I assume the record in that case would show that there was a proffer by the government that showed the requisite facts that they would have proven at trial, and that clearly would have been enough to satisfy the requirements of due process, and there is a constitutional right to plead under Alford. So how is that an illegal sentence?
I don't know that it was, but I think that your question is assuming an incorrect order of things under the Shepherd modified categorical analysis. It's not the sentence that was imposed that guides this court, it's the conviction. It's not the charge that was charged by the grand jury, it was the conviction. And in a pleaded case, we can be sure under Sixth Amendment precautions what the conviction was only by what the defendant admits. If the defendant admits all of the facts in the charge and all of the facts that might support the sentence, then we know that the conviction necessarily rests on those facts.
But what could he have been convicted of under that count one of that indictment that you're calling in the question, other than
possession with intent to distribute a controlled substance?
Right. What else could he have been convicted of?
Possession of intent to distribute a controlled substance. That's all that the statute says.
No, the indictment says Schedule 2.
The indictment says that, but the statute, the Maryland statute, only says possession with intent to distribute a controlled dangerous substance.
I'm sorry, I'm having a hard time. The indictment says Schedule 2.
Correct.
And so you're hypothesizing that maybe it was some other schedule?
No, I'm
okay.
I'm not trying to put facts out there.
Okay.
I mean, what
then
I'm.
What else was he convicted of, other than possession with intent to distribute a Schedule II CDS?
He was convicted of the generic bare statutory offense, which is possession with intent to contribute a controlled distribute.
A Schedule II.
It's not an offense until the drug is identified, I guess, is the point that Judge Davis is making.
It is an offense. It is an offense before the drug is identified, because the generic offense, and this is in this court's decision in James Washington, the generic offense is a controlled dangerous substance. And I'm not sure exactly how many schedules there are, but that covers all of them. So the generic offense does not include what a specific controlled substance was. In order to get that other, what the specific controlled substance was, you need to add a fact into the generic offense.
And in this case, that fact is in the charging document.
Correct.
Cocaine.
Yes.
Okay. I'm sorry, I'm missing something, Ms. Scull. Help me out.
The reason why that doesn't change the analysis here with the Alford plea is because the Alford plea admits the generic statutory elements only. That under the modified categorical approach, in order for a pleaded case to count as an ACCA predicate, you need to make sure that the conviction, not the charge, but the conviction rests on what the defendant admitted. Now, many times in pleaded cases, there's no difference. And
I'm suggesting this is one of those cases, and I'm trying to understand why you think it's not.
Because what the specific controlled substance is an additional fact that is not included in the generic offense.
It's in the charging document. I'm having real difficulty understanding why we should read that charging document as if the word cocaine is not there.
Because cocaine is not part of the generic offense, Judge Davis. So the charge.
But who? So what?
We don't know with an Alford plea where the defendant does not admit any facts. We know that the conviction itself rests only. We can say with Sixth Amendment certainty, and this is to avoid fact finding in violation of the Sixth Amendment. But we know that the conviction rests only on the generic statutory element.
I think I would understand your point better if the indictment had said cocaine or some other CDS. But the indictment simply says cocaine. And that's what he pled to. This is not like Austin where, you know, you plead to second-degree assault under Maryland law, and who on earth knows how that second-degree assault might have been committed. Here, he no more admitted that it was cocaine by virtue of his Alford plea than he admitted an intent to distribute anything. He didn't admit anything.
Well, I agree.
Except he admitted everything. He admitted everything by tendering a plea to that count of the indictment.
Which is why it's on such shaky Sixth Amendment grounds to use it for an ACCA predicate. And I would actually argue that he didn't admit that he distributed anything. He, in fact, explicitly said, I did nothing wrong. However, you know, I mean, there's form and there's substance, and there's form and there's substance. The statute does say possession with intent to distribute a controlled substance. So, you know, distribution's in there.
And then the statute goes on to talk about Schedule 1, Schedule 2, Schedule 3.
Those are different,
and it lists.
But
it
those
lists.
Are different statutes.
And it's all a part of the Controlled Substances Act.
The indictment specifically says the Maryland controlled substance statute, nothing else. It doesn't cross-reference anything else. We have the generic offense only. I think that in particular this court's decision in Cruz is 100% on point. There were additional facts in the charging document in that case that this court decided.
But those facts were not necessary to the conviction. We're dealing with a non-generic assault statute where even the slightest touching was sufficient. And I suppose, I wrote Cruz, so I suppose that's one way to distinguish this. You can't, there's no offense under this statute unless you identify the drug in question. If it simply says distribution of a controlled substance, what is the judge to hang his or her hat on with respect to punishment?
Those are different questions. What the punishment is a different question from what the conviction is. And an offense still exists.
You can't have a conviction for distribution of a controlled substance without identifying what the drug is.
Well, there could be testimony that something was a controlled substance or a controlled substance analog or any number of other things that could support a conviction. It's under Washington, under the statutory elements, we have one generic offense. Then we add facts from other places that make it qualify sometimes. I don't really think it's different from the situation in Cruz, because whether this is qualifying under the force clause or under the serious drug offense clause, either way, the modified categorical approach applies. The fact that there are different parts of the ACCA that would trigger the 15 years, that's not really the question. The question is, does the generic offense qualify? Yes, no. If no, you need an additional fact. Here we need an additional fact, and he didn't admit that additional fact.
All right, thank you, Ms. Skelton. You have some time left for rebuttal. We've extended your time. Ms. Kelly, we'll be glad to hear from you, ma'am.
Good morning. My name is Tanya Kelly, and I'm an assistant United States attorney in the District of Maryland. And I apologize, I did not handle the case in the trial court. The government requests that the court affirm both the conviction and the sentence in this case. The government submits that the firearm was constitutionally seized and that the trial court was correct in admitting the firearm. Secondly, the government submits that this conviction was based on not only sufficient but ample evidence. And thirdly, that the sentence should not be vacated because there is absolutely no dispute whatsoever as to what Mr. Hill's conviction was for, and that conviction was for the distributing narcotics, a controlled substance,
that's
which is cocaine.
Me, from the very beginning in this case, is why would a streetwise defendant ride around in a car with a gun that was rusted and wholly inoperable, hidden in a black sock under the seat of his car? Why would he do that?
Well, I submit, Your Honor, that when you use a firearm, the person who you're showing it to from 10 or 15 feet away has no idea whether it's operable or not.
Who would he be showing it to? Showing it to Ms. Bennett?
Well, the record in this case actually shows that he was carrying it around because he was having a dispute with the woman, with a man that Ms. Bennett was working with. And he said to Ms. Bennett in the car, this is in the trial testimony, and should have been in the motions hearing testimony, but of course there is none because this wasn't brought up on appeal.
Well, she didn't even specifically identify it as a gun, something hard in his pockets, all she said.
Which she believed to be a firearm because she has experience with them by carrying them every single day.
She believed, but she didn't know.
Absolutely, Your Honor. I mean, nothing is conclusive until the search of the car where there's one right within reach of him.
Is it the government's thesis that it was the rusted firearm in his pocket?
I don't know.
Well, that's a problem. We don't know.
It doesn't matter. For a conviction for 922G is just that he possessed a firearm after having been previously convicted. If he had the firearm in his pocket beforehand,
the evidence was it was his car. Well, that's the strongest evidence you've got.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And it's within reach. If you look at the pictures, if you look at Government's Exhibit 23C, you couldn't possibly get in and out of that car every single day for 8 months without seeing a stocking behind
you. Well, I understand the back seat of the car looked like a trash dump.
Well, it was his trash dump, Your Honor. That's what's important.
You know, you could have concealed anything back there, or whoever had the gun.
There are pictures taken directly before the search, and it is in plain, the black stocking is in plain view and in reach of the defendant.
I'm not going to make you use up the time on this, appellant didn't really address the issue, but that's troubled me why a wise guy would run around with an inoperable gun when he knew that he could be nailed for some hard time.
I wish I could say this is the first case that I've seen as an AUSA in Baltimore where we have an inoperable gun, but they're absolutely just as intimidating to people whether they're operable or not. The person who's looking at the gun has no idea whether it's operable or not, and therefore they serve the same purpose.
He was going to hold it up to him covered with a sock.
I submit that he'd probably take it out of the stocking first.
Think he would?
I do. I mean, when he got out of the car with it or whatever he was going to use it for. I'm just not sure it's necessarily relevant to the analysis here.
Get to your probable cause argument. I've taken up too much
okay.
of your time.
Your Honors, the government submits that there was ample, reasonable, articulable suspicion to execute a Terry stop in this case. The court has already pointed out that an armed woman walked into a 7-Eleven store and pushed a note over to two officers saying, help. The woman left the store and got back into the car armed with Mr. Hill. At that time, I submit that the officers had almost no other thing to do but to investigate the situation. And I agree with Judge Davis that it would have been a gross dereliction of duty to do nothing. And what the officers did is they approached the car with their guns drawn, and I submit that there are two factors in this case that, along the lines of the Perotti decision, where a more intrusive means of a Terry stop is warranted because of the situation at hand. And I submit that we have to look at the totality of the circumstances here. When the two officers leave the 7-Eleven and approach a car, there's two factors that are extremely important and allow for the more intrusive type of Terry stop. One is there's a gun right next to the defendant within 2 feet, maybe 1 foot. And two, he's in a readily movable car.
You're referring to Ms. Bennett's gun.
Ms. Bennett's gun, yes, Your Honor. And he's in
and
a readily movable car.
So her firearm was on the to the left.
In the record, absolutely, it's on the left. And Mr. Hill would be in the driver's seat right next to her and within a foot of the gun. And number two, they're in a readily movable automobile. It's not like he can't drive away at any given time. And what's to happen if he simply drives away? As they're walking up to the car to say, hey, Mr. Hill, what's going on out here? And he drives away.
You don't contend that there was probable cause to arrest him at the time he was shot.
I don't contend that. I believe that there
is. You contend that it was a Terry stop, albeit a rather extraordinary Terry encounter.
Yeah, I urge the court to look
for the reasons you allude to.
Absolutely. United States v. Perotti, the officers stopped a limousine, stopped it, blocked it, and came out with drawn firearms. And the reason that the more intrusive sort of type of Terry stop was warranted was because there was a person in the car that was in fear for their life. And it was a readily movable automobile. The government submits that this was a Terry stop,
and it was Mr. Hill's own conduct.
If she was in fear of her life, why did she go back to the car?
I'm not sure, Your Honor, but I don't know that that matters.
She was never asked that?
I'm not sure that that matters, Your Honor. At the time, what matters is what...
Whether she's trying to set up her boyfriend or not because they've had an argument.
Yeah, but the subjective intent of Ms. Bennett is absolutely irrelevant. What's relevant is what the officers are faced with at 4 o'clock in the morning at a 7-Eleven. And what they're faced with...
After her interview with the officers, doesn't it?
Yeah, and during the interview, she admitted that she was scared, that the argument was elevating, and that she needed intervention. So it wasn't certainly something that she thought that she could handle, or she would have walked out of the car and instead of going to buy some bread, walked to her apartment that was just minutes away. The government submits that it is Mr. Hill's own conduct that elevated this to probable cause by not complying with the lawful demands of law enforcement to put your hands up. It was at that time that Mr. Hill did not comply with the demands of the officers, but started reaching around in his dip area and towards the console, which is precisely where the gun was found. At
I'm
that
sorry,
moment,
probable cause for what?
To arrest him at that point.
For what offense?
For resisting arrest or
resisting
for
arrest?
A potential
oh,
assault.
Ms. Kelly, come on. You've got plenty to work with here. You don't need
there,
to be that.
Mean,
you don't need to be that extreme. Well, how on earth can you get a resisting arrest with a guy sitting in a car and the officer's 3 or 4 feet away holding their gun?
Wouldn't it be resisting arrest if he had
no,
grabbed
it wouldn't.
That gun?
No, it wouldn't. And you know that. Don't be so extreme. You don't have to be so extreme to win your case.
Your Honor, there was ample probable cause at that time for a number of things.
For
one,
what? I asked
is that
you,
they
for
were
what?
In
and
you,
your first answer was for resisting arrest. And
or,
I submit to
or,
you most respectfully that's absurd on its face.
Okay.
What was their probable cause to arrest him for
that
when
he was going
in the instant after they said, show us your hands, and he didn't show them their hands? What offense had been committed at that point?
That he was going to grab the gun and use it on the police officers or on Ms. Bennett, so assault. And really, at that point, the reason that they used force by shooting him was because they had probable cause to believe that their lives or Ms. Bennett's was an imminent bodily at risk of imminent bodily harm. And it is that at that point, this is really not an issue as to whether the probable cause, in my mind, the probable cause to arrest and the probable cause to believe that they were at risk of imminent bodily harm is sort of part and parcel. Whether it's because he's getting ready to assault them and you call it a crime assault, or because they believe they're getting ready to be shot, or they believe he's going to grab a gun and use it on Ms. Bennett, there's any number of things. But he certainly, at that point, is not complying with the lawful demands of law enforcement. And they believe, objectively and reasonably so, that somebody, Ms. Bennett or themselves, are in danger. And whether it be because you're, whatever crime you want to call it, whether it's going to be assault or possession of a firearm or any number of, there's all kinds of crimes it could be to grab a gun and shoot either Ms. Bennett or the police officers. And it's at that point that they seize Mr. Hill by shooting him.
I don't understand why it isn't sufficient for you to say, as I thought you were saying, that it was a Terry seizure. You don't think you can seize someone under Terry by shooting him or her?
I don't, my...
Is that your, just answer the question.
I do think you can, Your Honor. I just think that...
You think every time somebody gets shot, it's necessarily an arrest? Is that what you're fighting against here?
No, I don't necessarily call... I don't think there's a difference, really, under the Fourth Amendment. It was a seizure when they shot him. And the government submits that it was supported by reasonable articulable suspicion and probable cause. The government's point only in this discussion is that the court should take into account Mr. Hill's conduct in assessing what the facts were when he was
seized.
We're
not assessing facts. We're looking at what the lower court did with the facts, Ms. Kelly.
No, I understand, Your Honor.
You're not conducting a suppression hearing here. This is an appellate argument.
I understand, Your Honor. Ms. Skelton's argument is that the seizure occurred the second they walked out of the 7-Eleven, and so Mr. Hill's own conduct should not be evaluated in the totality of the circumstances. When the court concludes whether the seizure was constitutionally supported.
Is that issue preserved?
The government does not believe it was preserved.
Well, why don't you talk about that?
The government believes that it should not be acceptable for defendants to file boilerplate motions in the early stages of a case and never ever refine those motions and never ever put forth arguments as to these types of arguments later in the case as it develops, so that at the motions hearing, the government had no opportunity to even put on facts as to what exactly the officers had seen or heard prior to whether the terrorist
attack. That's the problem, isn't it? The district court was never given an opportunity to make findings as to exactly what happened here.
I submit that's absolutely true, Your Honor. I mean, there is a trial record, and the government has done its best to argue from the trial record, although I think this court would agree that facts that are developed as part of a jury trial are very different than facts that would be brought out at a motions hearing on probable cause determinations and Fourth Amendment violations and those sorts of things. I mean, at the time that this evidence was coming out, it was for a jury trial. And so just back to your point, Judge Davis, the government was simply trying to argue and disagree with Mr. Hill's contention that this court should not look at anything that happened after the officers drew their weapons in assessing the totality of the circumstances as to whether the seizure was supported by probable cause or articulable suspicion. And the government submits that the seizure didn't happen until Mr. Hill was shot. And so Mr. Hill's own conduct should absolutely be the part of the factors and the totality of circumstances that the court were to look at. At this time, I don't think that the court has a problem with the sufficiency argument. And so with the amount of time remaining, I was going to move to the sentencing argument. The government submits that the inquiry here is what Mr. Hill's 2007 conviction is for. It's not what did Mr. Hill admit in 2007. The ACCA statute.
Are you going to skip over the validity of the search warrant? Was it your intention not to address that?
I won't, Your Honor. The government, I can absolutely go back. The government does not
believe.
Well,
I'll leave that up to you. I've got some concerns about it, though.
Okay. Then I can move back to that if you'd like, Judge Kaiser. The government does not believe that the court case, the opinion in Doyle, means that this warrant in this case is facially invalid and therefore cannot, that it means that the firearm should be suppressed. The government is happy, Judge Davis, to concede a mistake here in that the Baltimore City Circuit Court officers who got this warrant absolutely made a mistake in leaving the word first degree murder in the application for the search warrant. But it's obviously a mistake because if it was meant in some way to deceive the judge, the affidavit wouldn't clearly say that everybody's alive and that Mr. Hill himself is in stable condition. There is testimony in the record from the affiant of the warrant that typically when he does police-involved shootings and that he just used the same face of the warrant that he used in most of his cases. The government submits that there's ample probable cause in the warrant to look for what is defined in the face of the warrant for weapons, ammunition, and papers of any item pertaining to the crime of murder. The government submits that Doyle, which was decided by this court, is not dispositive in that it's factually distinguishable. Doyle is just not a mistake case. In Doyle, the affiant asked the magistrate for permission to search for evidence of child pornography, and that would include itself child pornography. But in that case, there was only facts in the affidavit that the
that the target had engaged in sexual misconduct with the children. There was not probable cause that he had him, in fact, prior possessed child pornography.
Reflect what is to be searched for.
The
and in Ramirez, the charge was child abuse, and the warrant said search for pornography, and the court held that was an improper warrant.
I think that the most compelling distinguishing feature of our case is that the type of items that you would that you are allowed to search for is so different that there's a violation, that there could arguably be a violation of the defendant's right. Whether you're searching for assault with a firearm.
To me, child abuse and child pornography seem to be sort of flip sides of each coin.
That's exactly what the court in Doyle disagrees with, that just because a person engages in sexual misconduct with children there is not an allowed assumption that he possessed child pornography. In this case, they're searching for evidence of an assault with a firearm, which would be exactly the same
but
as a murder.
But the warrant doesn't say that. The warrant says murder.
I agree with you, Your Honor. The face of the warrant says murder, but the affidavit is specifically incorporated on the face of the warrant. I mean, the face of the warrant says the affidavit being incorporated by reference to this warrant and made a part thereof, so you don't have to look at them separately, as Ms. Skelton urges the court to do. The affidavit is absolutely part of the warrant, and while there is a mistake on the front of the warrant that says the crime of murder, the affidavit is abundantly clear that there's no murder. There's never been any argument that there's a murder, and absolutely provides probable cause that there was an assault with a potential firearm.
Are you saying that the affidavit supplements the items to be searched for?
There's nothing in the affidavit that is asking for additional items to search for. It's simply providing the probable cause to search for the items that are named on the face of the warrant.
It starts out, but doesn't it?
It does read
the affidavit.
Weapons, ammunition, papers of any item pertaining to the crime of murder. Yes, Your Honor. The government submits, though, that it's the pertaining to the crime of murder is a mistake, that it does not allow the officers to search. And I hope I'm obviously doing a terrible job of distinguishing here, but this warrant did not allow officers to search for evidence or items of something that the defendant didn't do, like in Doyle. In Doyle, there was no evidence that he had ever possessed child pornography, just that he had engaged in sexual misconduct with children. And the warrant allowed them to go look for child pornography. In this case, they're looking for the same thing. And so the mistake, while it's a mistake, and certainly the government concedes that and has always conceded that, even in the lower court, it's a mistake, and it doesn't enlarge in any way the items that the officers were allowed to look for. It did not allow the officers to look for items that they wouldn't have been able to look for. I mean, if this had just said pertaining to the crime of assault with a deadly weapon, the words would have been exactly the same. And that's not in Doyle.
Do you think they needed a warrant to search the vehicle?
I don't, Your Honor. I don't think Gantt actually compels that conclusion. I think United States v. Larry Johnson and the other cases about the automobile exception are clear that if there's a crime committed in a car, Gantt is about a crime being committed outside the car, not what happens after the arrest. The automobile exception is that if a crime is committed inside a car, then there's probable cause to search the car as long as it's readily mobile. And the readily mobile definition is simply that it's a car.
So they could have searched it there on the parking lot or as soon as they got it back to the
I absolutely believe, Your Honor, there was no need for a warrant.
They were being cautious by seeking the warrant.
Mm-hmm. I believe so, Your Honor. I believe the automobile exception would absolutely apply in this case.
Before, if you don't mind, Judge, before you sit down, I do want you to address briefly the sentencing issue. In particular, near the tail end of Ms. Skelton's argument, she mentioned this court's unpublished decision in Cruz, which I wrote.
And, I'm abundantly familiar with
okay. United States v. Cruz. I have been struggling to figure out how this case differs, and I suggested to Ms. Skelton that perhaps because we're dealing with a serious drug offense that focuses more on the sentencing component than the actual act, that would be a way to distinguish it. But I want to hear from you as to how you get around Cruz, if in fact Cruz means what Ms. Skelton says it means.
Well, Your Honor, the government's position is that the inquiry here is, or in the trial court, but to be reviewed here, is what is to determine what Mr. Hill's conviction was for, not what he admitted to or pleaded guilty to. That is what you're determining under the ACCA statute. What was this defendant convicted for? And Shepard restricts the documents that a court is allowed to look at in a modified categorical approach to ensure that the trial court is not engaging in fact-finding on disputed facts. The government submits in this case there is no disputed fact whatsoever as to what Mr. Hill's 2007 conviction was for. It doesn't matter that it was an Alford plea. If this had been a jury trial, I mean, nothing has changed since Taylor. So if Mr. Hill had gone to trial in 2007 and said, I'm innocent, I didn't do a thing, and we looked at the docket sheet and it said guilty to count one, would Ms. Skelton mean that we've engaged in a Sixth Amendment violation by looking at the charging document, the only thing that Mr. Hill could have possibly been convicted of? This is not a case where there's any disputed fact. There's a charging document, which is an indictment, which is passed down by a grand jury that says Mr. Hill in count one distributed cocaine.
Well, but in a jury trial, you've got the finding and the evidentiary support for that finding. Here, you've got the defendant contesting the facts and saying it's in my best interest to plead guilty, but I'm not admitting anything.
But, Your Honor, even Taylor talks about the fact that if all you have is a verdict by the by a jury of guilty, that looking behind that verdict too far could be a Sixth Amendment violation, and says that it's not looking too far behind the verdict to look at the charging document.
Okay, so before you run out of time here, you already have, so is Cruz distinguishable? Was it wrongly decided?
I think both, Your Honor.
Okay.
I mean, with all due respect, Judge Diaz, the government does not believe that Alston precludes, or any of the litany of cases preclude, in an Alford plea looking at a precisely drawn charging document, exactly like this one.
Well, Alston was not, as it turned out, they only found out about the Alford plea after the fact. The judge looked initially at the charging document in the hopes, and the government in the hopes of being able to see whether or not that document was narrowly drawn. It wasn't there. It was an assault charge. Then they looked at the plea colloquy, and that's when they apparently found out that this was an Alford plea, and as a result, the holding there was you can't rely on the plea colloquy. So I guess what I'm suggesting to you is that the charging document may be enough, but not always. It depends on the facts of the case.
I absolutely agree, Your Honor, that the distinguishing factor here is it needs to be a precisely drawn charging instrument so that there's no guessing as to what the conviction was for. There's a huge distinction between, you know, deciding whether something is an ACCA predicate is what the defendant's conviction was, not what he admitted to. So all that needs the inquiry here is what was Mr. Hill convicted of in 2007? He's guilty of count one. The indictment says he distributed cocaine. There is no doubt. There is no inappropriate judicial fact finding in determining that that is a predicate
conviction.
Okay,
and then my final question, then getting back to Cruz, if in fact the information in Cruz said, as I recall it did, that the defendant committed an assault and battery by contending with the officer and headbutting him, and Cruz pled pursuant to, it was a no-lo plea, it appears what you're suggesting is that should have been enough to satisfy the court in that case.
Your Honor, the government's position, with all due respect, is that the inquiry starts and ends at the charging document. And if the charging document gives you enough information, there's no reason to go further.
All right. Thank you, Judge. I appreciate it.
Sure. Any further questions, Judge Kelly?
No, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kelly. You have some time reserved, Ms. Bell.
Thank you. Several things I'd like to say. First of all, I want to say that Arizona versus Gantt would not allow a warrantless search of this car. There was no crime that occurred yet. There was only a crime if you believe that Mr. Hill had the gun. There was only a crime after that. What he was arrested for when they shot him, I still am fuzzy on.
Let me give you an alternative reality. They later learned from her, according to their testimony, that he had threatened her with what she believed was a gun while the two of them were in the car.
That would still not satisfy the car exception to a warrantless search.
And why, assuming he was effectively de facto arrested when he was shot, so that it's a Belton arrest of an individual in a vehicle. The arrest is not for driving on a suspended license. The arrest would be, viewed objectively, on the basis of probable cause to believe that he assaulted her, Miss Bennett, while the two of them were in the car using a firearm. Why isn't there, at that moment in time, forget what they know at that moment in time, but viewed objectively, at that moment in time, why isn't there probable cause to believe there's a firearm in that car?
Judge Davis, my argument would be much trickier if they had searched the car and found it then.
But it doesn't matter when they searched it. The question is whether there was probable cause at the moment after they shot him. That's what I was engaged with Ms. Kelly on, and I thought that's what you were responding to.
Well, I don't believe that that is sufficient.
And why not?
Because Mr. Hill was no longer had access to the car.
Doesn't matter under Belton. If there's probable cause to believe that, and Gant, if there's probable cause to believe that evidence of the offense providing the arrest is in the car.
I believe that Gant overruled Belton.
No, it narrowed Belton. I know that Justice Stevens and Justice Alito had that debate, but clearly it didn't overrule Belton. It greatly narrowed Belton, but it didn't overrule Belton.
Under the facts of this case, I don't think that there's probable cause to search the car
that
point.
Okay, go ahead.
I also would like to say that there's no question that a shooting is an arrest under Tennessee versus Garner. There's also no question that a Terry stop is a seizure. Ms. Kelly seems to suggest that the Terry stop wasn't a seizure, but I think it was an arrest when the police came out of the 7-Eleven. If it was a Terry stop, it still needed Fourth Amendment justification. It lacked that, but it was still a seizure.
Do you earnestly contend that an armed person surreptitiously slides a note to two police officers standing in the middle of the night at a 7-Eleven that says, help? She leaves the 7-Eleven and gets into a vehicle with another person. Do you earnestly contend that that's not reasonable suspicion to believe that criminal activity is afoot?
Your Honor, two responses to that. Actually, three. Three responses.
Three
or more.
Well, yes, no, and what's the third?
Yes, they had to investigate. No, it is not reasonable suspicion that Mr. Hill, particularized to Mr. Hill, that he was engaged in wrongdoing.
You don't think there's a reasonable basis to believe that Mr. Hill's companions, I mean, obviously it reminds at least me, I don't know about others, of this horrible case in Connecticut, and I'm sure it reminds you of it as well, where the mom is taken to these ATMs, mm-hmm. And, you know, dad and the daughters are back at the house. Isn't that like...
They had to investigate. And this brings...
And they had to investigate because there was reasonable suspicion that criminal activity was afoot.
But that's...
By somebody. And when they came out and saw he was the one in the car with her, clearly it focused on him.
Your Honor...
He's the one from whom she needed help.
I don't think that these give particularized suspicion for Mr. Hill, but I also don't think, under this court's decisions in Foster and Massenburg in particular, where there has to be something specific about him, and there's not yet, they haven't even seen him, but I also think that it exceeded the scope of a reasonable terrorist.
Well, Massenburg and Foster are seizure cases. We're search cases. This is a seizure case.
Well, they're part and parcel of the same thing, where the Fourth Amendment reasonableness in that case decided whether he could be seized at all. Here it would be discussing the scope of the seizure. The Supreme Court case of Florida versus Royer says that a valid Terry stop is an investigative method employed that is the least intrusive means reasonably available to verify or dispel the officer's suspicion in a short period of time. And that means that the manner of conducting the Terry stop must be reasonably related to the basis for initiating it. And here, it vastly exceeded that. I also want to briefly, if I may, say that this is not an honest mistake case as far as the warrant. The government cited a couple cases in their brief on what an honest mistake might be. The government's cases talk about a mistake made by someone else where the police rely on a third party's mistake. For example, where they get the apartment number from BG&E's billing records. BG&E gave them the wrong apartment number. They put the wrong apartment number in the warrant. This is something entirely outside of the police's control. Here, this mistake was entirely within the police's control. It is exactly the kind of reckless or at least grossly negligent conduct that the exclusionary rule is targeted. Doyle is not a mistake case. Doyle is a facially invalid warrant because it's not supported by probable cause. That's what this case is. It is a facially invalid warrant. The affidavit is part of the warrant. The affidavit does not provide probable cause for the search here. I know I've exceeded my time. I appreciate you allowing me to complete my thoughts.
If you don't mind, I'd really like one more word on this Austin, because I'm not getting it. And could you just take a moment and explain again why, under the modified categorical approach, what's in the record is insufficient?
The existence of a Shepard-authorized document, the fact that a couple of Shepard-authorized documents might exist, does not end the story. You know, there's a handful of things that it could be Shepard-authorized documents, and certainly in 9 cases out of 10, the charging document is one of those. But pleaded cases are animals unto themselves. Shepard says that when you have a pleaded case, what matters to determine what the conviction was for, not what the charge, but what the conviction is for, is what the defendant admitted to, the factual basis confirmed by the defendant. So pleaded cases are different. Still, most of the time, the charging document will be sufficient in a pleaded case, but Alford pleas change that calculus so that the existence of a charging document is insufficient. It's a Shepherd document, it's true, but that doesn't mean that using that Shepherd document in this case would alleviate the Sixth Amendment fact-finding concerns.
So your point in Alston is if the government in Alston had alleged the facts, and as I recall, Alston was a fact where a gun was pointed at 2 or 3 individuals, and the reason why the court refused to consider that in Alston was because it was part of the proffer that the defendant denied as a result of his Alford plea.
Correct.
But if those facts had been in the charging document, according to the government's argument, that would have been enough. And I guess I'm having trouble figuring out why the charging document is so much more different than the plea colloquy where you have a defendant saying, I'm not admitting to anything.
If those facts had been in the criminal information in Alston, it still would have been insufficient. That would have been exactly Cruz. I haven't actually read the Oklahoma statute at issue, but it seems from at least your description in the Cruz decision that the Maryland second degree assault at issue in Alston and the charge in Cruz are very similar expansive statutes.
Well, a number of people have said that they've made mistakes here, and I may be the next one in line here. We'll see how that works out after the.
I think you were absolutely right.
Well, we'll see.
Thank you very much, Ms. Skelton.